it's Canzano. Thanks for making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe and leave us some feedback. Also, the podcast is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic, dedicated to providing breakthrough, non-invasive, drug-free solutions to ED problems. Call Multnomah Medical Clinic at 503-899-4199 or visit them online at multnomahmedical.com.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast,
a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
B-F-F-T. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with The Bald-Faced Truth.
One of my favorite guests to have on this show is former University of Oregon defensive coordinator Nick Eliotti. Love having Coach Eliotti on the show. Love having him on. Love talking to him. A little bit of breaking news happening. Portland State has been granted its exemption by Oregon Governor Kate Brown. The Portland State basketball programs have received their exemption, so they'll be eligible to play. That has been a big story. I'm glad that's over with. Like, I'm not saying anybody should go out and be playing when it's not safe, but if you're willing to do the testing that the Pac-12 teams are willing to do, you should be out there and be able to play. So that's good news. Nick Eliotti, former Oregon Ducks defensive coordinator, joining. Anna's going to stick around for this interview because I think she has some questions for Coach Eliotti as well. He's joining us. All right, you have lunch with your grandkids today, or how did that go?
Yeah, it wasn't our typical lunch. Usually we go out and sit in a restaurant and get a chance to catch up, and I laugh with all the interesting things they tell me about their day. But because we're kind of on lockdown, freeze out, we just picked up big, what do they call them, Happy Meals through McDonald's, and we ate at home.
How did that go? Did you get a Happy Meal, or do you order something else?
I don't eat the McDonald's. I ended up going home and made myself a, believe it or not, turkey sandwich. Anna, don't laugh. I'm going to have turkey tomorrow. I had a turkey sandwich.
What are you doing? What are you doing? You're getting a jump on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, it's not the turkey that we're going to have tomorrow, you know, but, yeah, turkey, it's kind of healthy. It's a little bit better for me than probably Mickey D's, as the kids like to call it.
Yes. What is it? Do you have a tradition? What do you guys do at the Eliotti household on Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, there's a lot of Thanksgivings, John, that I was actually coaching and had meetings and stuff and didn't get the typical Thanksgiving. But, you know, growing up younger, the younger Eliotti, we would always have a big family dinner and have a turkey bowl, always played a big football game out in the front yard. In later years, the tradition has become more, particularly in retirement, I'd say the last 7 years or so, we have a family dinner with my son and daughter and my son's kids. And then we pretty much, the biggest tradition I would say is we do go around the dinner table and everybody gives us something that they're thankful for.
Yeah, we do that too. We do that here. Is that an Italian thing? Because Anna's looking at me. I'm like, we're going to do this. We're going to go around the table. Where did you learn that?
You know, probably from my mom and dad, but, you know, it's quite interesting, as you and Anna probably know. It's great to hear what Nina, Nico, and Naya are going to say, the three grandkids, 8, 6, and 4, as to what they're thankful for. And usually we want the youngest to go first, because if she doesn't go first, she'll just repeat what the oldest says and the second one says. So,
I love that.
So we have to mix it up.
Yep, that's good. So being from an Italian family, John has said that on multiple Thanksgivings that he remembers from childhood, Grandma would include a pasta, a gnocchi, or some other kind of pasta along with the turkey as
like
a side.
A side.
Yeah. Did you guys have that?
Absolutely. And
really?
Our side, Anna, was raviolis.
Yeah.
My grandmother would make homemade raviolis. Yeah. And, you know, Italians, especially, it sounds like John, myself, and John's dad, according to what I've heard, I could eat pasta almost every day. So there was at least, yeah, it's a scary thought. Not my wife, though, Anna. She's probably a lot more like you. But anyway, I could eat pasta every day, but we did have a side during Thanksgiving. And growing up, Thursdays and Sundays nights were always some form of pasta dinner.
Yeah, we had mandatory minimums for the week. Everybody knew, oh, it's Thursday. We haven't had pasta yet. It's going to be 3 days in a row. Nick Eliotti is with us, former Oregon defensive coordinator. Oregon and Oregon State are going to play. How much football have you been watching? What do you think of what you see at Oregon? Especially, let's talk about the defenses, because that's what you your specialty and expertise is in. What do you think about Oregon's defense right now? What are the issues?
Well, they're struggling against the run, if I remember correctly, and I do watch almost every game that's on TV. Kath does not like that, but I do. I spent a whole Saturday from 7 a.m. game day till about 11 p.m. watching every football game I can. But I concentrate on the Pac-12. But that being said, getting back to your question, Stanford, I think, had over 200 yards rushing, John and Anna. And UCLA, I know that Felton had 164. I don't know what the final total was, but it had to be close to 200 yards rushing also. They are not tackling great, which is always something defensively you need to be able to do, particularly in today's football game with an open space game. Tackling is it's a lost art, and in space it's not easy to do all the time. But I think they're struggling. When I go back to the run game, let's see if I can make this plain for your listeners. UCLA ran a lot of outside zone stretch plays where they pulled one or two offensive linemen to the side of the play. And when that happens, your linebackers, your inside linebackers in particular, have to have a different fit, meaning getting inside or outside of those pulling linemen, depending on their assignment, and come downhill to close those gaps to bounce to the next guy. Now, that's not easy to explain on a radio show, but I think they're having trouble with stretch plays with pullers in their fits.
You know, after the game, Oregon's offensive line also, they struggled to run the ball against UCLA, and there was a lot of talk about movement, a lot of stunting, a lot of stemming. Can you explain to the listener, as a defensive coach, if you're coaching or game planning against a young offensive line, how can movement create problems for a young offensive line?
Well, let's start with stemming, John and Anna. Stemming means you align in one front, and before the ball is snapped, you see Washington State do that a lot if you watch them most recently, but before the ball is snapped, they move to a different front. Well, that means the communication that happened prior to them stemming is now has to either be done on the move where the two adjacent linemen understand how they're going to block that, or there has to be a quick communication. So that, number one, causes a problem. Stunting is a different thing. That's either lining up in something and then on the snap moving to another place, or bringing a linebacker from the outside or the inside of your defense. So stemming is something that happens. You give an offensive look, then you move, you give them a different look. Stunting is something that happens when the ball is snapped and people change where they aligned and go to a different gap.
Is that, you know, hopefully, and it's interesting. Yeah, it does help. But I think, you know, and from when you have a young offensive line, it makes sense, because a lot of those guys are just worried about getting lined up right and what their assignment is, and then all of a sudden you throw one more thing at them and the game's moving fast for them.
Absolutely, because what the defense is trying to do, as I tried to explain, is confuse the offensive lineman. And the younger an offensive line is, the less experienced it is, they miss that communication or don't get it on the move. So it's a great defensive ploy that when I was a coordinator, we liked to stem and we also liked to stunt and move. So those two things can be very disruptive. Now, conversely, if the defense is not, when they stunt, getting into their proper gap, then you could have a big hole and that becomes a gash play for you defensively. So both sides have to work on that stuff.
Thank you so much for including me on these answers that involve
that.
Really technical football lingo. I appreciate that. We've got, you know, the game formerly known as the Civil War coming up, Oregon, Oregon State. Did you, you know, how much did you buy into that rivalry? How much do you did you enjoy it? Do you have memories of previous matchups that you can remember and share?
Absolutely, Anna. You know, the rivalry, whenever the proximity of two teams and you know your opponent, meaning our players knew a lot of their players and vice versa, and were close to the other coaches, like at Corvallis, Oregon State, and Oregon, that game becomes a big deal because it's bragging rights for a year, the winner of that game, regardless of your record. That game's so important to both sides. But the two I remember the most, one was when I was an assistant at Oregon State. Having coached in 1983, I hope I have the year correct, I coached in the last 0-0 tie
yep.
in the history of college football. Okay? So that was like, I mean, two bad teams playing about as bad a game as you possibly could play. I mean, think about that. Two of the worst teams in the league playing about as bad a game as you could possibly play to a 0-0 tie. And then the second one I remember, which is a fond memory, is our 94 team when Shanklin threw that pass to the corner of the end zone that went incomplete. We'd win 17-13 at Corvallis, and we were going to go to our first Rose Bowl in a long time. Those two really stand out to me.
In that 0-0 game, it, you know, the story goes that it was, the rain was torrential, 11 turnovers, 4 missed field goals. As that stuff's happening and you're coaching in the game, are you groaning, or is it kind of like, does it almost become a little bit comedy as neither team is making a field goal and everybody's kind of bumbling around?
When you're in the moment, it's not that much of a comedy, especially when that game and those games are paying your bills, okay? But after the game, Miss Anna and John, after the game and a couple years down the road, you go, oh, my goodness, how bad were we? How bad were these two teams? I mean, and it was a torrential downpour. It was sideways. The field seemed like there was about a half an inch to an inch of water. Nobody could even make a 35 or 40-yard field goal. And the most exciting play was Oregon in their last play, in a last-ditch effort, kept doing that, you know, the play at the end of the game where you keep lateraling it backward and backward and
yeah.
keep it alive as long as you can. Yeah, it was a game that I'll never forget, but a game – that I never have to repeat again when I'm if I'm ever coaching again.
I'm curious if I can jump in. You know, you were the defensive coordinator for like 15, 16 seasons under three very different coaches, Mike Bellotti, Chip Kelly, and Mark Helfrich, three very different personalities. How do you manage up? What's your advice? Because, you know, they were so different.
That's a great question, a great question. First of all, Mike and I went to college together. So that was kind of an easy one because probably Mike didn't like this, but I was able to tell him what I thought whenever I wanted, you know, behind closed doors, not to make it an embarrassing thing or be insubordinate, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But, you know, our relationship was much different, Anna, because we're best friends today. Chip had been the offensive coordinator And when he took over, he decided to keep me as a defensive coordinator. And Chip was an interesting guy because he just is an interesting guy to begin with socially. But the one thing I appreciated about Chip is in the 4 years that he was the head coach at the University of Oregon, and I was his defensive coordinator, and trust me, this is unheard of. He never said one word, not one word to me during the game on the headset. Hmm. That is very unique. But he had it was a different personality than Mike. And then Mark, being a younger guy coming in, when Mark took over the job, I told Mark that, look, you're a new head coach. You're a young head coach. If you want to get your own coordinator and start anew, I have no problem with that. I'm ready to call it a day anyway. And he said, no, I want you to stay. So I stayed for one more season just to try to help him through the transition. So I guess I was more of a confidant or, you know, on the advisory board for Mark in that regard. So those are the three personalities and the three ways I handled it.
Nick Aliotti, former Oregon defensive coordinator. You can see him on the Pac-12 Network now. He's with us. Before I cut you loose, you talked about sort of that last year with Mark Helfrich, and I thought I had always found you. I always had a good relationship with you. I could always talk to you. You're real. But I thought in that last year you did a little more looking around and enjoying it. Was that just me, or did you kind of soak it in knowing, hey, this is probably going to be it? Did you kind of look around a little bit and enjoy it?
I looked around and enjoyed it. I knew, John, it was the last go-around. And my goodness, we take ourselves, and I certainly did, we take ourselves way too serious when we're in the moment. In Oregon at that time, we were having great success, and it became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bottom line is, it's a job, and you need to have fun in your job. You should enjoy, and everything's not fun about your job. Let's face it, you know, your job, my job, anybody's job. But you need to enjoy it to the fullest. And that last year, I told myself, I'm really going to enjoy this thing. I'm going to let my hair down, so to speak, and I'm going to go out my way. And, yes, it was so much fun. I wish I had coached like that and enjoyed it more while I was in the moment all the time. And shame on me for not doing so.
I think a lot of coaches never get that time, right? Because they get told, hey, it's time to go. And a lot of jobs end with coaching staffs getting fired or let go. And you had a chance to kind of call your shot. I've told Anna the story, and maybe you can recount it. Was it the first time you asked your wife out, or the first date? Was it at a baseball game? Is that kind of the story? Or how, where you met her?
It was at a baseball game. Get a kick of this, Anna. You know, back in the day, 1975, I was wearing overalls with a pink circus softball shirt underneath and slippers and no socks. And that's how I met my wife at a baseball game. And I'm telling you, to this day I'm going, how did that work? But, yeah, that's how I met Catherine at a baseball game at UC Davis.
Wow.
Where you were a running back.
I was a running back.
Do you ever think you'd end up on
what,
the... Yeah.
I think Anna adds to this show.
Tell us how.
You should keep her on after COVID-19.
Okay.
I think she's outstanding. First of all, John, I love your show. You know that.
Thank you.
I know. I don't need to butter you up, but I think your show is fabulous. But Anna has added to the show. Anna, you are awesome. Stay with this thing.
Ah, thanks, Nick. I appreciate
it. I'm going to keep her. Hey, Coach, I really appreciate you making time. And happy Thanksgiving to your family. And for people who don't know, Anna, I don't know if you know this, he's doing homeschooling now with the grandkids during the day. Like, you know, this is, there's a whole...
sea of grandparents out there that are now, you know, doing, you know, justice for their grandkids and helping. And
God bless them. That's not what they probably expected to be doing in retirement in their golden age. But, yeah, that's amazing.
Coach, thank you. Thanks for coming on. Happy Thanksgiving to the Aliotti family.
Happy Thanksgiving to the Canzanos, excuse me, and everybody else out there listening. Enjoy the day. Stay safe. John, appreciate you. You guys have a great day.
There he is, Nick Aliotti. He says you should stay on the show. I think we'll do that. He texted me that yesterday. He's like, you know what? She adds something to the show.
He's just so positive. He's like a burst of Italian sunshine.
Yeah. I always liked him. And I liked, a lot of times as a media member, you're in a combative relationship or you're put in a you know, position of mistrust with the people you cover because they don't want to share things with you because they know if they talk to you, it ends up somewhere else. He was always someone I could talk to at the back of the room while, like, the head coach was up talking. I might wander back and just stand with him and say, what do you think? Mm-hmm. And as a media member, I didn't have all the answers. There's a lot of media members out there that walk around like they know the game as well as the coaches. They have the answers. If you did, you would be coaching. Mm-hmm. You need to shut up and you need to listen. And what I learned or what I did is I would go to people like Nick Aliotti who were willing to take the time to talk with you and explain. And instead of just criticizing, you know, he'd be the first to say, we screwed up, you know, it was bad coaching or, you know, we made some assignments. We just didn't have, you know, maybe we didn't work hard enough during the week on getting the kids to grasp what was going on. He'd be the first to tell you that. Mm-hmm. And you kind of maybe reaffirm what you're thinking. But if you were out in left field, he would tell you, like, no, here's what you saw, but here's what was really going on. And I really grew to trust him, not just in his assessment of Oregon, but even as in his assessment of Oregon State and some of the other schools. And there are coaches on every staff. If the media members would just shut up, ask a simple question, a short question, and then go quiet. Be quiet and listen and pay attention to what they're saying because these guys are experts mm-hmm. in their game. Experts. He did it for 3+ decades at a high level. You know, and he thinks you're good on the show, so... We know he knows some radio, too.
I guess I'm going to stick around.
Stick around. Leave it here. State of Oregon, Oregon Governor Kate Brown has cleared Portland State's men and women's basketball programs, given them an exemption. They will be able to scrimmage. They will be able to play. University of Portland got one earlier in the week. They will be able to scrimmage and play just like Oregon and Oregon State. You know, for those of you out there that are celebrating it, great. Doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to be any easier for them because they will still have to adhere to strict protocols and you know, rapid result testing and antigen testing and PCR testing. But also for those out there that are saying, well, what are you doing? What are you advocating? Why are you putting young people in the line of fire? Here's what I would say to that. I don't think young people should be in the line of fire. I take this pandemic seriously. But if you could be rapid tested, if you could get a daily antigen test and you could get a PCR test once a week, you would be much safer. I would be much safer. Your family, my family, we'd all be much safer. And in fact, we could ensure by contact tracing that we're not spreading it to someone else if we got a positive test. Like if everyone in America could be tested on a daily basis, we could wipe this thing out in a month. But we can't. We can't be, you know, it's just not affordable. But Portland State, UP, Oregon, and Oregon State basketball programs are willing to do that. They're also subject to strict quarantining if they do have a positive test. So they're not out of the woods here. It just gives them the opportunity to go out and you know, have an opportunity to play games and scrimmage. Let's go to the phone lines. David in Portland is called in. David, what's on your mind?
Well, I was thinking about your meals and the traditions and the like.
Yes.
And of course, I grew up in a neighborhood where you had to have a vowel at the end of your name in order to be in the neighborhood. And when we'd have Thanksgiving dinner or any, we'd always have the orphans and waifs and other people. But the first course for all of our family Sunday dinners was pasta of one sort or another. Always, 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 always. And if you had a guest, you know, they have some more pasta, have some more pasta, and then they'd bring the entree. And they'd go, wait a minute, I ate. They just, they weren't used to it.
It's like
but
a
it
buffet.
Just wasn't, it wasn't, it's, you couldn't have, I say Italians have a family reunion every Sunday. And you couldn't have a Sunday meal without pasta, or almost any meal, maybe three times a week, but always on the Sunday meal.
Yeah.
And the same thing went with a bottle of wine. If there was nine people at the table, five women and four men, there'd be, six bottles of wine, a bottle of wine for each guy, and a bottle of pasta for the women.
Yeah, I remember that. I used to sit at my grandparents' house. I had my grandfather sat at the head of the table. Okay, he was at the head of the table. I sat to his right in the first seat, which meant the bottle of wine was more often than not either on the table right beside me or on the floor right beside me. Like my grandfather sometimes would have the big jug of wine and he would put it down on the floor by his seat. And I would slowly watch the wine disappear over the course of the dinner until my grandfather would go, oh, it'd be a shame just to leave that little bit in the bottom of the bottle. And he'd just pour the rest in his glass. But what kind of, in Asian households, Anna, in your household growing up, I think part of the reason why Italians had pasta was it was cheap. There were immigrant families that were blue-collar families. It was affordable. You could feed a lot of people with some spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
Is the same true, because, that we talk about rice in Asian cultures or noodles in Asian culture or dumplings in Asian culture?
Oh, yeah, dumplings are huge. So, around the New Year's or holidays, you gather and everybody participates in this assembly line of making dumplings. It's homemade dumplings. They're the best.
Not that different than maybe Mexican families doing tamales.
Tamales, yeah.
And they have the party and everybody has, it's an assembly line.
Yeah.
Henry Ford would be there putting the olive in. And, in an Italian family, it was homemade pasta. We don't do that here. Like, I've made gnocchi with my grandma's recipe a few times.
Uh-huh.
But my grandmother used to make, the homemade ravioli.
Amazing.
Like, melt in your mouth.
Yeah.
Like, ridiculous. They can't even do it justice by talking about it good.
Well, and think about everything you learn from those Sunday family dinners that literally took place every Sunday. I mean, your grandfather was such a storyteller. Imagine, everything that you gathered in those sessions where he would hold court and you guys would just sit for 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Dinner would be consumed. Then there would be dessert. Then
yeah.
There would just be sitting around and talking for a really long time.
There would be like a prelude. There'd be some run-up. And then it would be the dinner happens. And then as soon as everybody started eating, my grandfather would always say, hey, how come it gets so quiet when all the food's here? And then my grandmother would scold him and tell him to shut up in Italian. And then we would keep eating. And then after a little while, he would tell a story about the time his dad came to watch him play baseball for the first time. My grandfather played catcher. Batter foul tipped the ball and hit my grandfather in the throat and he fell over. The punchline is, his dad went home. His dad didn't check to see if he was okay. He just went home. His dad was a factory worker and went, this is not fun to watch my kid get hit in the throat with the ball. And then he would tell another story after a little while. We hear the same four or five stories. But what I got out of it is not only can I repeat the stories like almost verbatim how he would repeat them, I learned how to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that a lot of people, when they tell a story, they're so eager to get to the payoff.
Yes.
It's like those YouTube videos, the YouTube videos that are wildly popular to have millions of views that are of people opening a present or opening a package
a
blind bag.
Yes.
There's something in your brain. Literally, there is a chemical reaction in your brain with serotonin. Your body is getting boosts of dopamine and you're literally getting a high
mm-hmm.
watching those videos. It's why everyone likes to watch because you want the payoff.
Mm-hmm.
Of what's in the package?
Mm-hmm.
He's opening an egg. I can't, here comes, and they're crinkling it.
Yeah,
you
there's
know?
That sound element,
oh,
too.
Oh, let me see what's in here. It's your brain. It's going, payday, payday, payday. The same is true if you tell a story. You need to take your time getting to the payoff. Play with the package a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them about it. I can remember my grandfather telling the story of, when he was a kid, they played because, you know, they were immigrant families and there were Italian families. And then, you know, in the next town, it might be, you know, the Polish families. And they'd play these football games that was almost like bigger than the Civil War. Like it was, this was for bragging rights for the next year. And he had on his team three brothers that were in the backfield. And they called him the Bagali brothers, right? And he used to tell this story that there was Whitey, there was Eddie, and there was Felix, but they called Felix Vinegar Face. And for years, I would say, you know, I was like, as a kid, you grow up hearing about Vinegar Face. And then later, I asked him one day, Grandpa, why did you call that kid Vinegar Face? And he said, well, all of us kids one time, we were rummaging through like garbage, at, you know, behind this business, and we found a box of gunpowder. And we decided to light it off. And Felix happened to be holding it. It burned his face. Oh, I said to my grandfather, I said, that was horrible. And then you made fun of him afterwards? And he said, yeah, but that's what we did as kids in those days. And I'll never forget. You and I went back there. We went back to Pennsylvania to see where this all took place.
Yeah.
In this tiny little town in Vandergrift, Pennsylvania. And we went to the cemetery. And we stood on the grave plot of the Bagali brothers. Uh-huh. Like, and to me, it was like watching a movie and you get the final scene where it all makes sense to you. I finally, like I'm standing there. These were real people he was telling us about. Mm-hmm. But he told the story so well that they became almost like mythical, you know, characters. And, you know, in the old days of baseball, when you heard the stories of, you know, Ty Cobb and Honus Wagner and the Wainer brothers. And, you know, it was like you finally had faces for these people. I don't know. Part of that experience was learning how to tell a story.
So valuable.
Leave it here. You got the Bald-Faced Truth statewide. I'll give my picks in the upcoming Pac-12 games. And Anna will give three can't-miss predictions in the pop culture world. That is next.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Faced Truth.
Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Faced Truth radio show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Faced Truth radio show. Thanks for listening.